Welcome, loyal listeners, back to Tim Talk. We have a great discussion today about advancing health equity with a man who has been talking that talk and walking that walk for decades. Dr. Linwood McAllister is the Assistant Clinical Director for the Morehouse School of Medicine Physician Assistant Program. And in addition to that, he is a multidisciplined and credentialed professional who has done extensive work in education, public health, academic medical centers, healthcare, consulting, and public policy. Dr. McAllister, thank you for being my honored guest.
Thank you so very much for having me.
My pleasure. You have done so much work to advance health equity and promote community health over the course of your career. And by the way, I just have to say, you know, for a lot of individuals, the terms like health equity and promoting community health are kind of new, especially health equity, kind of a new term. Even though then others that have been in the, you know, health profession for a long time will say, oh, well, that's what we've always done. There's something I think we can really, really learn from an individual like yourself that has indeed been advancing health equity and promoting community health over the course of your entire career. So what are some of your proudest moments and accomplishments?
Believe it or not, some of my most proudest moments have nothing to do actually with healthcare per se. So I am a professor, and so I get tremendous satisfaction, tremendous joy from the teaching process with all my young students. So my focus of studies are around American government and public policy. So I love teaching that subject matter and broadening the minds and scopes and opinions of students. Seeing the process of students, especially young adults, because of their own station in life is being politically socialized in terms of from their parents, from their loved ones, from their close social friends, and how to give them a different perspective so that they can do what, at the end of the day, make up their own minds about issues, especially when it comes to our politics and different ideologies within our government system. So I absolutely love teaching. As well as that, I enjoyed the mentorship process. I had the pleasure and having and still have the pleasure of mentoring so many students at different levels in education, all the way up to the doctoral level. And I get so much satisfaction from that. In terms of healthcare, because it is so huge in terms of putting your finger on, am I making a difference here? Am I helping someone? So it's almost like trying to boil the ocean sometimes. Like you really, it's so huge. So I try to be as fundamental and simplistic as possible. Did I help someone? Did I assist someone? Was I part of someone's process in learning education? And in fact, if I was a part of that in a positive manner, are they going to move forward as a practicing clinician to help others? So I just have that faith in a sense that the work I've done is similar to almost like planting a seed, but I won't necessarily see the seed grow. And I won't necessarily get the shade from that particular tree, but I was part of the process. So those are some of the things that bring me complete satisfaction over the years I've been in healthcare and just over the years in my career.
I love your last analogy, the tree analogy, Professor McAllister. When you say greatest joy and satisfaction, and you mentioned teaching and mentoring and broadening minds, you know, really reminds me of one of my I was speaking to a group the other day, and the question posed was, how are you changed? How did the pandemic, these 3 years, you know, make you different? And I said, not necessarily make me different, but one thing rose to that, you know, within me. And that is being inspired by those that I serve. So, you know, leadership, especially crisis time leadership, oftentimes it's, you know, are you an inspirational leader? Well, I get inspired hour in and hour out by the people that I work with, you know? So I think you and I, it's a common bond in the way, you know, when I ask you that broad question of your entire career, what are your proudest accomplishments? It's people's whose minds you've broadened. And that's fabulous.
It's about service. To assist and to help, and that brings the most satisfaction, and it's part of my core values and core principles as far as to be a servant for others.
So. That's it. True. Now let me ask you. We clearly asked you to be here for this, our special Juneteenth podcast, because much of the work you do aligns with the Juneteenth celebration. And as I said to you as we were getting warmed up, Northern Light Health honors and celebrates Juneteenth. It's one of our official holidays. And we know that we want to encourage people having a deeper understanding of that. It's not just a day off, you know. It's not something in your PTO bank. It's got real significance and meaning. So, you know, historically, a lot of people would say that, you know, the day commemorates June 19th, 1865, when the enslaved Africans of Galveston, Texas, got the news by way of the Union Army troops that had ended up at Galveston at the tail end of the Civil War, about freedom that had come at last about 2.5 years before, when President Lincoln signed the Emancipation Proclamation. But let's keep in mind that it was also 6 months after the 13th Amendment to the United States Constitution was passed. So really, really significant day. But Juneteenth isn't just about celebrating a day or a single historical event. It's a celebration, and all Americans, all people, should rally around this celebration of freedom, resilience. What else would you add to that list, Professor?
It's also a moment for the nation to pause and look back at our history, and to look back at our history not from a flawed point of view, not to look back at our history as tainted, but just to embrace how far we have come in this nation. Do we still have so much further to go? Absolutely. So we have to take this moment just to pause and understand that African-American history is American history, right? So we celebrate the 4th of July's Independence Day, July 4th, 1776. We declared our independence. Our founding fathers and those authors of the Constitution spoke about life and liberty. All men are created equal. But at that point in July 4th, 1776, all men were not created equal. So we know that enslaved Africans were not included in this declaration. We knew that women were not included in this declaration. We knew that indigenous Indians of North America were not included in this declaration. So as this nation evolved and we come up with this idea, this experiment to create America based on rules and laws, a constitution, this nation is a document, a living, breathing document. And our forefathers had such foresight to understand that the demographics of this nation will change. And in order for us to form a more perfect union, in the preamble, to form a more perfect union, that we will have to change. We will have to include enslaved Africans. We would have to include indigenous North American Indians. We would have to include women. We would have to include all of those who were left out and were not granted the privilege and the sovereignty of being a United States citizen and all the privileges and rights that that come with. So we can see over time, leading even from the point of the Declaration of Independence to the Emancipation Proclamation, we could see a period that this nation was changing. When we look at what Juneteenth represents, many people, even some people in my community, in the Black community, don't fully understand the significance of Juneteenth. Especially if you were raised in the northern parts of our nation. If you were living or raised in the South, you had an idea. I had friends who grew up in Texas or grew up in Georgia. They knew what Juneteenth was. But growing up as a young person in New York City, I didn't know what Juneteenth was until, you know, I saw it as a young adult on my own and understood what Juneteenth represents. So Juneteenth, we have to begin to not treat it separately in terms of what it represents compared to Independence Day and Juneteenth, because I think that sometimes we are caught in that separation or in a sort of way of a dichotomy. One represents what? White people, independent, and the other represents Black people. So we have these two ideas on both of our shoulders speaking to us. No, it's American history. So on this Juneteenth, we must take a pause and we must understand that this is about a struggle about what is known for us as freedom. It's very simple. It's freedom to have to be treated as a full citizen, and that means have all the rights and privileges, to be treated with dignity, to be treated with respect, to be treated with equity, and as well as justice. So this is what this moment, this Juneteenth means, is that, and this is for all people who have been marginalized and not fully included in the sovereignty of these United States of America.
Excellent. Thank you so much, Professor. I really enjoyed listening to you describe that. Let me ask you about Morehouse. So obviously, you know, coming from Morehouse School of Medicine, it has produced an impressive list of graduates that have championed social and medical justice. As a matter of fact, we've had more than one on this podcast series. And the college continues to do so. Before we talk about your latest endeavors, what would you like our listeners to know about the Morehouse legacy, which is world-renowned?
Morehouse was founded in 1975 to not only provide opportunities for students of color, in particular African Americans, to become physicians, as well as to diversify the workforce. So Morehouse School of Medicine has a rich history that lies in creating health equity for our society. So we take a step back prior to Morehouse School of Medicine. And so we look at historically, if we look at medical education, so a little over 100 years ago, a report was written by Abraham Flexner, known as the Flexner Report of 1910, right? And within Flexner's report, prior to Flexner's report, there were over 25 what will be considered Black historical medical schools. After Flexner's report, that number went down to 3 medical schools that were considered ranked and to receive support, financial support through other entities such as the AMA, so forth and so on. So historically, schools of medicine from an HBCU perspective are necessary. We can see that if we look at the number of physicians, especially of color, they are not in proportion to society. And as this society grows and as this society becomes more brown, there will be a need for physicians that represent what our society looks like. This is not to say that white physicians are not significant. That's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is that when we look at health outcomes and we look at how patients of color respond, there is a better response to comply with physicians or practitioners that look like you. So there is definitely a need in order for us to address some of these health disparities that exist in our society. Mall School of Medicine provides those opportunities for practicing clinicians, residents, medical students, PA students, to enter into a workforce, to diversify that workforce, to address the needs of those who need it most, those who are underrepresented in our society, and those who have less services in our society. So Mall School of Medicine is significant when it comes to that, but from a historical perspective.
Yeah, you know, fabulous. And when I think of, the challenges in our health system, for example, and where we have the need to recruit more professionals, more physicians and PAs and nurse practitioners and nurses and the like, I also look at the corresponding information showing that predominantly rural states like Maine is have far more unmet needs. And so we need more providers. And so when I hear you describe the importance of Morehouse and training the professionals, absolutely that connection. There's new data coming out now on breast cancer in women and so many other examples where exactly what you're talking about, there's a professional force that can really connect. Patients feel easier to share from a trust point of view, and the providers maybe have a different set of radar, in talking to the patients, if I may say that, then healthier outcomes happen. So what's not to like about that? And everything is to learn about that, right?
Mm-hmm. And we have to, in a sense, we have to address this concern immediately because we know that we are dealing with a physician shortage in this nation. So we're not producing enough physicians. So from an allied health point of view, from a health science point of view, from being part of a interdisciplinary team point of view, physician assistants will play a vital role in addressing the needs of our nation, of our citizens in terms of healthcare.
Yeah, so true. So now to make it more specific, I guess, to your work in the physician assistant or PA program at Morehouse, tell us about the program and the goals, but I also want to hear like how it is part of you.
Okay, so the PA program, the basic PA program in terms of accreditation standards, usually around a 28-month program that include didactic curriculum, students doing their didactic year, which is approximately 15 months here at Morehouse School of Medicine. They received classroom education that talks about disease pathology, anatomy, physiology. They also participate in a capstone program research project that is culminated at the end of their PA education. Then the second half is their clinical experience. So the second half of their education involves clinical clerkships. These clerkships are areas of internal medicine, family medicine, surgery, pediatrics, emergency medicine, psychiatry, or behavior health, or and OBGYN or women's wellness. And students also has opportunity to participate in an elective. Many students may have interests in, say, podiatry or dermatology or podiatry, and they can select an elective. And also part of that is emergency medicine as part of one of the core specialties. So that's basically what the PA program here is at Morrill School of Medicine. I think more importantly, what our program represents is the need to diversify the workforce. If we look at PAs, so 69.4% of PAs in this nation are Caucasian, and Caucasians only represent 60% of the population. 3.9% of PAs are African American, compared to we represent 13% of this nation. And as far as Hispanics and Latinos, 7.5% of those PAs are Latino or Hispanic, but they represent 18% of the population. So there's some disproportion in terms of PAs within our population. It's disproportionate to our population. So what's key and what's so important about what we do here at Morrill School of Medicine in terms of advocacy is that we're trying to diversify our workforce. And in diversifying the workforce, that means that we are going to improve the health outcomes for those individuals, again, who are underserved. What does PA program means to me? So I've been in medical education a little over, I would say, 14 years. If you go back to my days of being in public health, and what it means to me, it's almost, life is funny. Life is funny. So I grew up in New York City. Specifically, I grew up in Harlem. And I'm not going to tell you the period I grew up in. I don't want to date myself. But I grew up and I received 95% of my health care at a public health service, a public health center within my community that was not adequate in today's standards to provide health care. That had an impact in terms of the work that I do. I also grew up at a time where the life expectancy for African-American men in New York City was below the life expectancy for those in Bangladesh, a third world country. So those things had a huge impact in terms of the decisions that I made in terms of a career-wise. We all are sum totals. Up until the moment that you and I spoke on this phone, we are all just sum totals of all of our experiences. That's who we are. So my entire life, I had family members who were impacted negatively in terms of the due diagnosis of hypertension and diabetes. And I saw the poor level of care. Personally, my father passed away because of diabetes and because of lack of education and compliance and diet and all those things that are, you know, so commonly known now, you know. So all those things have a huge impact on my decision to do the work that I do and to love the work that I do. And I know what it feels like to, from a patient point of view, I know what it feels like to not get proper care. I know what it feels like to not be heard, to not be seen. I know what it feels like to honestly feel like a second-class citizen when it comes to healthcare. So these are all the things that drive me. And then I tell everyone this also. The work that I do is very selfish. It's very selfish. And I tell you why it's selfish. So I talked about my service and my support for these young learners, but it's selfish. It's selfish in the sense that I know at some point in my life, especially around end of care, those who I have assisted and supported, there's a high probability that they may be the clinician in the room that I'm in and I need their care. So it's selfish. There's a very high probability because I am human too, in terms of, you know, the decisions I make to choose my own practitioners. I have chosen, if it could be implicit or it could be on purpose. I've chosen clinicians that look like me throughout my life. So there's a high probability that one of these young learners will be taking care of this old man. But the work that we do here at Morrill School of Medicine is very, very important.
Yeah, Professor, I love that. And I tell you, if that kind of selfishness would pervade, we'd all be in a much better place, right? I appreciate that very much, the way that you said that. So now we're celebrating Juneteenth, and I just want to say, you know, some of the things that you said really resonated with me. It's an opportunity to take a pause. Let's reflect on freedom. It is for all. It isn't for one segment of our population. And term you didn't use, but I've been using a lot lately, is unfinished business. It's not, we're not dwelling on where it's, you know, not working right or broken, or somebody doesn't like this, or somebody uses a, you know, derogatory term. You know what? It's unfinished business, folks. That's what, you know, a more perfect union, as you quoted. That's really it. So I'm going to let you have the last word on that and Juneteenth and the meaning of it. But that really drove home with me. So I'm sorry I interrupted you. Keep going with what your thought was.
That's okay. So I was going to say that we all have to sit up when we see someone's rights being violated. We all must take a stand, right? This thing is about justice, right? And it's about tolerance. You may not accept someone's lifestyle. You may not accept someone's preference or orientation. You may not accept those things. But when you see one's rights being violated, especially when laws are unjust, and the saying goes like this, any law that's unjust is not a law at all. And so when we see some of these unjust laws, we need to pause. We need to sit up and we must recognize that this may not be my fight, but it might not be my fight right now. Because if I don't stand up for this person's rights, and you can have your own level of what is called political efficacy, is what you feel, what you can do to change how our government works. Some people protest, right? Some people sign petitions, right? Some people may blog about it, right? Some may do a podcast about it. It's whatever the level of your political efficacy, how you feel you can change the government. But we all must take a stand when someone's rights are being violated, because you know why? You're next. Because one day you're going to walk into work, or you're going to walk into an establishment, and you know what? We're not letting you in here because your shirt is purple, and no purple shirt people can come into this establishment. And then now you have an understanding, you have the empathy to understand what it feels like when someone tries to take your rights away. So it's very, very important that we take this moment on Juneteenth to look at what is being coined as this wave of freedom, right? To look at what it is to have dignity and respect. And I want to read a quote by James Baldwin to close it out. James Baldwin said this. He said, "If one really wishes to know how justice is administered in a country, one does not question the policeman, the lawyer, the judges, or the protected members of the middle class. One goes to the unprotected, those precisely who need laws protection and listen to their testimony. Those are the ones who are have been marginalized, those groups that have been denied rights. These are the groups that we must listen to. We must take time to listen to understand that the struggle for freedom, it is never ending if we all are not encompassed in it. Because if my rights are being violated, sooner or later, it will be your rights that could be violated. So on this Juneteenth, I think that is important as a nation and for your listeners to just take a moment to pause and think about historically where we are in this nation. We are in unprecedented times when it comes to where our democracy is. We must understand the severity of where we are as a nation. And if this republic, this democracy is going to survive and move forward, we are at a serious inflection point in this nation. And we can rise above it and we can improve it and we can make it better because we have a lot of work. There is a lot of reform that needs to happen. There are a lot of things in this country that needs to change for the better. Or we won't be a nation at all. I don't know what that will look like. I don't know what that will look like. I don't know what that will feel like. So this is a moment for all of us to take this time to reflect and to make some very difficult decisions about where we want to go from here as a nation on this Juneteenth.
Wonderful. Professor McAllister, I really appreciate you. I thank you for taking your time out and sharing your thoughts and perspectives with our listeners. It really means a lot. And to you listeners, I wish you a wonderful and reflective Juneteenth. Hope you really think about some of the universal truths that were shared today on this podcast by Professor Linwood McAllister. And so on that note, until next time, I'm Tim Dentry, encouraging you to listen and act to promote our culture of caring, diversity, and inclusion that starts with caring for one another. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Tim Talk. There are several ways you can tune into Tim Talk. You can find new episodes on our website at northernlighthealth.org/podcast. We are also on Google, Apple, and Podbean, which makes it easier for you to listen on the go on your favorite app.